Even though Marshall is still up in Williamsburg, and Will Stevens says Rankin is long gone. Just the same, I got a bolt put on my door and sleep with a knife next to me. One of them shows up, this time, he's a dead man. During the day, I don't have time to think about this too long. Even though everybody in the big house is gone, I got my hands full with the gardens and Jamie and Suki. I wonder how Lavinia's doing without her Suki. At night, Suki was crying, keeping me and Jamie awake, until Mama finally takes her and puts her with Beatty. That helps her some, but now she's not wanting to eat. Mama says it's like that little girl lost two mamas. First Dory, now Lavinia. Truth is, when Mama took Suki at night, it made it easier for Ben to come see me. He can't stay away, and I don't want him to. First, though, I go to Ida to get something so I don't get caught with no baby. She said it only works for some, never did work for her. But so far, it's working good for me. My Jamie is everything to me, but I don't want no more babies. Come a day I got to run, one child's enough for me and Ben to carry. Then there's Lucy. Me, I don't like her. Just thinking about her living there with Ben makes me mad. But Ben don't want her knowing about us. He says if she finds out we're getting together, it's gonna hurt her. And Ben says she already got hurt enough in this life. Then, too, we don't want Mama or Papa to know about us. But I know Mama. She'll find out soon enough. And then, look out. Last night we got to laugh when I say to Ben that something's not right, that at 24 years old, we're still watching out for Mama.
Chapter 29, Lavinia. In 1797, Williamsburg was no longer the capital, but the town was noted for three remaining institutions. One, the focus of the town and the local gathering place, was the courthouse. It was an impressive brick building, centrally situated, and appeared much as an anchor for the main thoroughfare, the Duke of Gloucester Street. A man of law, Mr. Madden was intimately familiar with this workplace. The second, also central, was the College of William and Mary. Established in 1693, it had maintained an excellent reputation as a school for higher learning, particularly for law. It was at this institution that Marshall would further his education. The third, the one that eventually took on most significance for me, was the public hospital. It, too, was a fine brick building. This one, built in 1773, sat on the edge of town and was more commonly known as the Hospital for the Insane. Its reputation was growing, and it was to this hospital that Miss Martha was admitted. The hospital accepted only those who were dangerous or curable. I was never told under which of these two categories Miss Martha was signed in. The Maddens had an inviting home. Within easy walking distance of the courthouse, it was a rambling clapboard house, and though certainly impressive in size, it was not as large as the big house I had left behind. There were many rooms in this home, but the ceilings were low, and the rooms were more compact, more intimate, than those in Tall Oaks. Many of the windows held cushioned window seats, while on other wide window sills, indoor plants flowered, often perfuming the room. Although there was a library, books were casually set about in other rooms, and I guessed rightly that reading in this household was routine. The furnishings here were not as extravagant as at Tall Oaks, but they were substantial enough for one to know that this home belonged to a family of means. At first glance I was taken aback by the colors of the rooms, painted in rich and vibrant hues, although in a short time I adjusted to that particular style of decoration. To my great astonishment, I was given my own small upstairs room. Later, I was to learn that I was placed here, as this room was attached to the larger bedroom next door that was intended for Miss Martha's use on her return from the hospital. Nonetheless, I was astounded to be sheltered in the main house, and to have it decorated so prettily. My room's lively green contrasted pleasingly with a white coverlet on the footed bed. A circular braided rug covered much of the pine floor, and on the edge of it sat a small oak desk in front of a gabled window. I looked out at the broad and busy street below, outlined by large elm and locust trees, and through them I saw other homes, similar in character. Some appeared in need of repair, but almost all were surrounded by lush gardens, filled with flowers, herbs, and shrubs. My hosts had only one child, a much-loved daughter named Meg. On my arrival in Williamsburg, she greeted me enthusiastically. She was 12 to my 13 years, and though we had both grown since our first meeting years ago, now she was significantly shorter than I. She was slim, and her limp was more pronounced than I remembered. But her frizzed brown hair floated out as before, and I must say that on first approach she struck me as an odd creature. She wore round eyeglasses, but while listening to you speak, she removed them and peered directly at you, her large brown eyes never leaving your face, almost as though she were trying to study what generated your thoughts. For the first few weeks, I was so shaken by my abrupt change in circumstances that I am not certain how I would have made it through had it not been for Meg. I found it especially difficult to reconcile living within the confines of a town. The constant activity unsettled me, and I found the sudden shrieks of neighboring children or the unexpected rattle of carriages going by unnerving. During the day, with so many around, the atmosphere of town living felt constricted, and I longed for the open fields and forest paths I had left behind. But in Meg's bedroom I found solace. In it was the world of birds and botany, the natural world that I thought I had left behind. I was delighted to see that she collected nests, too, and had them lined up across the windowsills amid rocks and leaves of all kinds. Framed fern species covered most of one wall, while prints of birds covered another. All of them, she told me, were indigenous to the region. As I studied the prints more closely, I was startled to hear a gravelly voice call out from a far corner.
"Hello?"
I swung around. "Sin Sin," Meg said, going over to a large wicker cage. "You must be nice." She opened the door of the cage and held out her hand. A large black bird stepped out, hopped to her shoulder, then cooing, nuzzled her ear. "This," said Meg proudly, "is Sin."
"Sin?"
"Yes, I called him Sin. Mother named him. He is not her favorite. Black is Sin," she said the day I got him.
"Would he come to me?"
Meg beamed.
"Of course."
The bird came willingly and gave me giggles while he searched my hair with his beak.
"What does he eat?"
I asked.
"Mice, frogs, peanuts, fruit."
"What kind of bird is he?" I stroked his iridescent black feathers.
"He is of the genus Corvus, a black crow."
She spoke formally as a schoolmistress might. "I found him when he was very small, and he imprinted on me. He is quite intelligent, and I've taught him to speak." While she put him through his paces, I looked about the room. A small plant, roots and all, was propped on her desk, and I saw on an open drawing pad the beginnings of a sketch. Seeing my interest, Meg brought out another prized possession, a long, oval-shaped tin box painted a light blue. She explained that it was used to collect plant and animal specimens from the outdoors. It was attached to a leather strap, and she slung it over her shoulder to demonstrate how she could open the attached lid with one hand. The lid itself was delicately hand-painted with white and pink wildflowers, though some of the decoration had been worn away from use. "It was a vasculum," she said, rolling her tongue around the word as though it were candy. I was awestruck when she pointed out her shelf of books. They were all gifts from her father, she said, meant to assist her in her studies. After Sin flapped to a perch above the desk, I sat in a small chair to recover myself and stared about in fascination. Meg was thrilled at my interest in her world, and within days we were bonded. At the beginning, I was scheduled to take only reading and writing lessons with Meg. I was given some household duties, and Miss Sarah had her Negro servant, Nancy, instruct me in those chores. Desperately lonely for the family I had left behind, I tried to establish a friendship with Nancy and her daughter, Bess. Nancy and her husband, along with Bess, lived on the Maddens' property in a small home out back of the kitchen house. The two women cooked and cleaned and kept up the home under the supervision of Miss Sarah, while Nancy's husband maintained the property and the substantial gardens. While working at my chores, I made overtures to Nancy and her daughter, but they, knowing nothing of me, kept their distance. One afternoon, finding myself with free time and thinking to pursue their friendship, I went out to the kitchen, and there asked if I could be of help with the cooking. They looked at me stone-faced. No, I was told. Everything was just fine. They didn't need my help. Later that day, Miss Sarah came to me and asked that I not disturb the servants. They were very private, she said, and did not like others in their workplace. In my naivete, I was confused by their rejection of me, but made no further attempts to win them over. At first I thought Miss Sarah overbearing, but in time I came to understand that her intentions were well-meaning. Miss Sarah took her household seriously, and though her family was her first priority, her social obligations were also of great concern. Since her childhood, she had been afforded a place in society that carried with it luxury and privilege. Her mother had stressed the obligation of station, and Miss Sarah was determined to carry out her duty. I often heard her state how she felt obliged to help the less fortunate, and there was no doubt that my welfare was included under that dictum. For Miss Sarah, appearance and propriety were of utmost importance, though she herself was stout and her taste in clothing did not lend itself to flattery. She had a weakness for sweets, and as a result, her brightly colored dresses were often more fitted than the seamstress intended. Like Meg, Miss Sarah had an odd inclination to stare at one while he or she spoke, but what set her apart from her daughter was that Miss Sarah silently mouthed along with the speaker, as though to better digest the words. Mr. Madden was away a good deal of the time, but when not lawyering, he was taken up with gardening. He indulged Meg at every turn, which left Miss Sarah to draw a more solid line with her daughter. It was over dinner that I first witnessed the closeness between father and daughter. Both loved the world of botany, but while Mr. Madden kept his interest largely to his garden, Meg sought to understand what lay outside their domesticated backyard. I was amazed to learn that Mr. Madden was the one who provided much of the live food for Sin Sin. To Miss Sarah's dismay, it was often a topic discussed during our meal. There were days when I forgot to eat, so intrigued was I with the unusual dinner conversation. In due course, Mr. Madden tried to include me, but I was so stricken by shyness that I was almost unable to respond. It must have taken the better part of a year before I could look him in the eye to answer his questions. I must add how surprised I was on the first day when I was told that I would dine with the family. Heretofore, I had not sat at a formal table such as theirs. Guessing my need, Miss Sarah jumped at the task of guiding me through. I was eager to prove myself, and immediately patterned myself after her example. In the weeks that followed, Meg insisted that her mother release me from my household duties, so that I might take part in all of her lessons. Our tutor was an older widow, Mrs. Ames, bright enough, though often sidetracked and much given to gossip. Daily, but for Saturday and Sunday, we had morning lessons in reading and penmanship. Art and music were reserved for 2 afternoons a week, while dance classes were given on alternating days. The rest of the time, we had the freedom to wander out on excursions. Initially, I would have liked to go to the downtown shops to see for myself what I had heard existed there. But Meg was uninterested. So in our free time, I assisted Meg as she gathered new plant specimens for botanical study, or I helped her devise new ways to catch a fresh dinner for Sin Sin. With each passing month, I was introduced to other aspects of a new and pleasant world. Yet, though most of my days were spent in happy pursuit, always underlying was the tenuous feeling of an uncertain future. I was told on more than one occasion that my education here was to enhance my opportunities, but I was never informed as to what those opportunities were. Fearful, I kept the questions to myself, I was not ungrateful for the fortunate circumstances I found myself in, but through all my time in Williamsburg my deep longing to return home did not abate. Early on, when writing a letter to Belle, I considered entering a plea for her assurance that I might one day return, but after reflection, I knew the futility of asking for her intercession and decided otherwise. That decision, though, left me feeling more alone than ever. I dreaded bedtime, as that was when homesickness overtook me. At night, my lovely bedroom felt empty and lonely. In the dark, I felt sick for the scent or touch of Suki, and I longed for the late-night kitchen sounds or the familiar voices of Belle or Mama. Before sleep, I could not stop the memories. I replayed Suki's run for the carriage over and over, and when the pain was too great, I took my blankets from my bed and arranged them on the floor to resemble my old pallet. From there, I pulled Mama's basket from under the bed. I removed each treasure, then gave myself over to the impotent sorrow that engulfed me. When I finally slept, I often dreamed that I was on a ship. I would wake, my heart pounding from fear of the next wave, the one that would wash away all that was familiar. The daytime was easier, as I had constant distraction. I was interested in all of the classes, but dance instruction provided the most amusement. Dance was taught by Mr. Degatt, and accompanying him with a fiddle was his longtime friend, Mr. Alessi. The two shared a home but often did not see eye to eye, and each thought nothing of correcting the other's work. There were days when our class was suspended because one or the other stomped out, leaving only half a team to continue alone. Considering their interdependence, the one-man attempt was usually unsuccessful. After one such episode, Meg informed the table at supper that evening of their latest unhappy drama. The two men were already tense when the class began. When a misstep happened between Meg and Mr. Degatt, Mr. Alessi stopped his music and voiced the opinion that if Mr. Degatt had moved to the left instead of to the right, all would have come off as intended. Mr. Degatt expressed the view that if the fiddle playing had been more even, he would not have been so distracted. Mr. Alessi declared that his fiddle playing was above reproach, and perhaps Mr. Degatt would like to apologize for such a slur. Mr. Degatt assured him that he would not. And with that, Mr. Alessi put down his instrument and left the room for some clean air. Furious, Mr. Degatt walked over to the resting fiddle, picked up the bow, and snapped it in two across his knee, and then carefully replaced it beside the fiddle. Having spent his rage, he came back to us, nervously glanced at the door, then clapped us to order. Class would go on, he informed us. He would hum the accompaniment to our dance, and hum he did, after partnering me with Meg. We had scarcely begun to dance when Mr. Alessi strode in. A scream of outrage followed the discovery of his split bow. As he made his exit, he announced that Mr. Degatt was a vile and wicked man. In response, Mr. Degatt only hummed louder as he waved us on. Mr. Alessi had been gone under a half hour before Mr. Degatt developed one of his debilitating headaches and had to cut our class short. At the story's end, Mr. Madden, not one to voice an opinion on such matters, questioned Miss Sarah if she might want to consider hiring another fiddle player. Miss Sarah reacted with surprise. They came as a team, she said. And did he not realize that Mr. Degatt was the very best instructor of the very difficult minuet? Besides, she said, the two of them always worked out their differences. I glanced at Meg, and could see that she was as relieved as I when Mr. Madden did not voice any further disagreement. We both enjoyed our dance class as it was. There was a Latin class taught on Saturday morning, and I was surprised to learn that it was taught by no other than Marshall. This was a free day for him from his own school, and by special arrangement made with his uncle Madden, he agreed to teach Meg the language he studied there. Although I had little interest in the subject, I was suffering from homesickness and looked forward to seeing Marshall. Upon our first meeting, he greeted me kindly and did not seem surprised at my new position in this household. I'd had only a little to do with him the previous year when he had come home to visit his father, but I did recall the attention he had shown me. And now, simply by seeing him, I felt a happy connection to the family I had left behind. It was routine on Saturdays, following the lesson, for Marshall to stay on for the afternoon dinner. Mr. Madden and Miss Sarah showed a genuine interest and affection for Marshall, and because of my own similar needs, I recognized how he thrived on their attention and approval. Marshall was a handsome young man, everyone said so. His blonde hair had darkened to a sandy color, and if a facial feature had to be named as most prominent, I would reference his firm jaw and strong cleft chin. He had a full mouth, straight white teeth, and eyes of the bluest blue. Always well-groomed, he stood over 6 feet in height and was broad-shouldered and of excellent physique. Marshall was a good teacher, and although he confessed he did not have a deep passion for botany, it appeared to give him satisfaction to help Meg decipher the Latin terminology that held for her so many of nature's secrets. So, given my shared enjoyment of botany with Meg, and the appeal of Marshall as a teacher, I began to look forward to the Saturday class. One night after a terrible bout of homesickness, I formulated a plan. I decided that Miss Martha must recover, and when she did, I would return home with her to serve as her companion. That was when I first began my plot to see her. In the first months when I asked to visit Miss Martha, Miss Sarah left no doubt with her adamant refusal that the hospital was not a place for someone of my age. I noted that Miss Sarah herself made fewer visits each month until, finally, late one Thursday afternoon on her return, I overheard her speaking to Mr. Madden. I unabashedly stopped outside the library door to listen. "It is simply too horrible to speak of. I convinced him to come, and now to have this happen," she said. "He is her son," Mr. Madden replied. "You were right. It was time he went to visit."
"But you don't know," she began to sob.
"Begin then, my dear." "I don't know if I can speak of this," she said.
"You must. Tell it to me straight."
Once Miss Sarah began, she told the story in a rush. "I said, 'Marshall, she is your mother. You are her only hope. Seeing you, she is certain to respond.' He didn't want to come. I could see how pale he was even as we approached the hospital. In the lobby he had to sit, but I, thinking he might inspire a breakthrough, all but forced him to go through with the visit. She was sleeping when they unlocked her cell to let us in, and I suppose because of that the attendant didn't stay. Marshall took his seat on a stool in the corner, and immediately across the way another pitiful woman reached her arm through the bars and screamed for his help. When I saw how this affected him, how he trembled, I took pity and was about to suggest we leave, but that was when Martha woke up. She was calm until she saw Marshall. Before either of us had a chance to guess at what her actions might be, she rose from her pallet and flung herself upon him. When he tried to free himself, she caught his face and kissed him in a fashion that... surely she thought him her husband. When she began to... God help me! To touch him, he was in such a stupor that he could not protect himself. It took me calling for the attendants before he was able to free himself. Miss Sarah choked back sobs.
"Oh, my dear," Mr. Madden said.
"But that is not all," she murmured, and I leaned in closer to better hear.
"What then? Say at once, and we shall never speak of it again."
Before we could leave, before we could make our exit, she lifted her skirts and urinated. When his wife began to sob, I imagined Mr. Madden holding her to him while he soothed her. After she quieted, he asked again about Marshall. "He would not speak to me in the carriage. When I took his trembling hand, he pulled away. I tried to apologize for my part, but he would not look my way. How could I have failed him so dreadfully?"
"You did not fail him, my dear. You were right to include him. Of course, you would presume his presence to have helped."
"But I might have guessed. Remember last Christmas dinner, when he had too much drink, how he claimed that Martha hated him,
that she blamed him for Sally's death, and do you remember his anger when he spoke of her extreme laudanum use throughout his childhood?
But isn't laudanum one of her treatments now? Mr. Madden asked.
No. They've stopped it. There was a silence before she continued. As it stands, I can't see how she will ever be released. They've tried everything. They bleed her every week. They purge her. They've tried intimidation. And then the restraining chair. Many times they've used the cold bath, but nothing is working.
My dear, Mr. Madden said, why do you continue to visit? What possible purpose can it serve?
I cannot abandon her, Miss Sarah said. It is my responsibility. She is alone all day in that terrible cell. She sleeps on a pallet without even the dignity of a bed. They won't give her cutlery. She is forced to eat with her hands, like an animal.
Does she know it is you when you visit? Mr. Madden asked.
There are times after she's taken exercise in the yard, the mad yard, they call it, when she appears to have some recognition. But then she pleads for the baby, or for our sister Isabel. I feel I must be honest, yet she grieves so when I tell her they are both dead. I could take no more, and victim of my own indiscretion, ran to my room with this news that further troubled my already sleepless nights. The following Saturday, after the visit to his mother, Marshall did not come to teach our Latin class, nor was he present for our afternoon dinner. On Miss Sarah's insistence, Mr. Madden went out to find him. The search ended in the late evening when Marshall was found drunk in a tavern some miles from town.
Meg was already asleep, and I was with Miss Sarah in the front parlor when Mr. Madden returned with his nephew.
Marshall was so inebriated that it took the three of us to get him to a bedroom. As we settled him on the bed, Miss Sarah and I saw his right hand was badly bruised and cut. Together we cleaned it, and though our nursing must have pained him, he communicated only through incoherent mumbling. When he began to retch, we turned him to his side, but from the state of his clothes it was clear that his stomach had already given up everything but the blood-stained gall that he now spat out. When he slept, we all retired for the night, only to be woken later by shouts from Marshall's room. By the time the Maddens reached him, he was crashing about the room. Meg stood with me in the hallway, and we comforted each other until Miss Sarah came and sent us back to our rooms. There was activity the night long. Unable to sleep, I dressed at dawn and went out to ask Miss Sarah if I might be of service. Her eyes were red with fatigue.
"If you could just sit with him, I might sleep for an hour," she said. "Mr. Madden is preparing to leave. He must see to take care of the consequences."
I took the chair alongside the bed, assuring Miss Sarah that I would call if I should need her. After she left, I shyly looked over at Marshall, who slept. Where during the night I had been frightened of his state, now he lay pale and vulnerable. I was reminded of his worst days as a child, of his haunted face after the death of Sally, of his beaten appearance when I found him in the privy, and my heart opened to him. How like his mother he looked, I thought, and I plummeted into sad longing for everyone at Tall Oaks. I could not help my tears and was drying my eyes when I became aware that Marshall was awake and looking at me.
"Don't cry," he said, reaching his bandaged hand toward mine.
I stared in horror at his swollen purple fingers. At my reaction, he took note of his hand and rose on his elbow to take better stock. With that movement, he began to retch again, so I held the basin and comforted him, as Mama May might have done. His face was damp from the strain, and when he rested back, I placed a wet cloth across his forehead. His blue eyes met mine, and when he tried a smile, I felt a rush of tenderness toward him that I had known only with Suki and Campbell. I wanted to comfort him then, to hold him as a child in my arms, but I knew it was inappropriate, and I held myself back. Confused by my feelings, I was happy to leave the room when Miss Sarah came to relieve me. I did not see Marshall again until the next day.
He was still too sick to eat and could retain only sips of water. Miss Sarah stayed at his bedside, but eventually joined the family downstairs for breakfast. "He says the only thing that appeals to him is maize soup," Miss Sarah told us.
"I don't believe coddling will help the matter,"
Mr. Madden said, helping himself to another waffle.
"Perhaps a few days with an empty stomach will teach him."
"He must eat."
I spoke so passionately that everyone at the table stared at me, and I felt my face grow hot. "I'm sorry." While Mr. Madden concentrated on his food, Miss Sarah spoke.
"Of course Marshall will be given food, my dear."
In silence, I choked down the rest of my breakfast, then asked to be excused. As I made my way up the stairs, I overheard Mr. Madden's remark.
"Loyal little thing. One can't fault her for that."
I waited until later in the day when I found Miss Sarah alone before I told her that I knew how to make Mama May's soup. "Could I make it for Marshall?" I asked, and she gave her permission. Nancy and Bess did not welcome me into their kitchen, but neither did they hinder my work. They watched as I caught, killed, and cleaned the chicken, then chopped the parsley, onions, and thyme. I simmered the soup exactly as Mama May had taught me, and it was finished by evening. Miss Sarah was leaving Marshall's room as I brought a small cup of the steaming broth upstairs. Her concern for him was clear.
"I don't know,"
she said, looking at the cup I carried.
"I doubt he can tolerate even that."
"Could I try?" I asked.
"Go ahead."
"Can you manage if I go for some supper?" she asked,
and I assured her that I could. By lantern light, I saw how little Marshall had improved. He looked at me listlessly as I perched on the edge of the bed.
"I made you some soup," I said.
He looked at me.
"I can't eat, Lavinia."
"This is broth. I made it just like Mama May showed me," I said, as I placed a napkin across his chest.
When I offered him a spoonful, he shook his head, but I persisted until he opened his mouth and swallowed the warm liquid.
"Good,"
I said. I waited before offering more. Marshall did not take his eyes from me. Concerned only that he keep the liquid down, I did not rush, and in between spoonfuls, disregarding his gaze, I watched the flickering shadows in the darkening room.
"This is good," he said.
"I know," I said. "I had some in the kitchen."
He gave a small laugh.
"Do you feel better?"
I asked.
"I will if I can keep this down."
He took a deep breath.
"I heard that you took a stand for me."
"What do you mean?"
"At breakfast."
"I only said that you needed to eat."
"Is Uncle angry with me?"
"I think so."
I waited a while. He turned his head to the wall.
"Well, it isn't the first time."
"What do you mean?"
"He has charge of me until I am 22, and he is always trying to control me. Laying boundaries and setting standards, he calls it."
I had no answer to that, and settled the spoon in the empty cup. I rose to leave.
"Will you stay?"
he asked. "Would you like me to read? I can turn up the light."
"No. Just sit over there. Talk to me."
I wondered how I would entertain him, but no sooner had I taken my seat than his eyes closed, and soon he slept. In the night, Miss Sarah gave him another cup of the broth, and in the morning he was asking for more. During the next few days of Marshall's recovery, I helped Miss Sarah care for him. Meg wanted nothing to do with the nursing, though she did take a critical look at his wound when we changed the dressing. She declared there was no infection, then instructed her mother and me to carry on. Miss Sarah lifted her eyes to the heavens and shook her head when Meg made her exit. When Meg later returned, it was with Sinsin perched on her shoulder and playing cards in her hand. That afternoon, and in the afternoons following, we played some lively games of loo. In all, it was almost a week before Marshall left again.
During that time, Mr. Madden arranged for Marshall to board at the home of one of the professors from the College of William and Mary. The professor and his wife ran a tight ship, and there were curfews that would be enforced. At Marshall's discharge, Mr. Madden extracted a pledge from him to stay clear of alcohol and, in the future, to have wine only with dinner. Once I had learned of Miss Martha's sorry circumstances, after I knew that she had asked for me, for Isabel, I felt compelled to see her and to have her see me. I grew convinced that if she saw me, she would become well again. A few weeks following Marshall's illness, I suggested to Meg that our botany excursions take us in the direction of the public hospital. The place was well known, commonly called the Madhouse. It was situated alone on a 4-acre plot in a relatively undeveloped part of Williamsburg. It was within walking distance, and I shamelessly used the untamed woods behind it as a temptation for Meg to discover some new plant specimens. Although the two of us were given an unusual amount of freedom, I knew this was forbidden territory, as it was understood that our botany excursions were limited to the town park and to neighboring gardens. Meg, as I had hoped, was not bound by restriction and saw the excursion as an adventure. I believe that initial visit was toward the end of October, my first year in Williamsburg, for I recall how Meg and I remarked on the red and yellow of the autumn leaves. We kept to the periphery of the woods that sheltered the hospital, and while Meg foraged, I found a space to peer between the tall boards of the wall surrounding the mad yard. An occasional shriek or shout came from this outdoor space where the patients took their exercise, and though fearful, I was eager to see what I might. The day was cool, but the sun bore down into the enclosed area. My nervous eyes settled on a slight figure seated on a bench across from my makeshift window. As I watched, she pushed a heavy blanket back from her thin shoulders. At first I didn't recognize her, but there was something in the way she angled her head when she shrugged back the gray blanket that helped me identify her. I saw no attendants and called out to her, "Miss Martha!" My voice broke, but I called again. "Miss Martha!" She heard me and looked up, much like a startled bird. I pulled my handkerchief from my pocket and waved it through the broken slats, then called again. She saw the white flash of my cloth, and her blanket dropped when she stood. Then she walked toward me as one who slept, sliding her feet one after the other. I saw she was cared for, although her clothes were plain and cut loosely from a heavy brown homespun. Her beautiful long silky red curls had been cut short, and not anchored by pins or combs, stood away from her head in clumps. Dark blue half-moons emphasized her sunken eyes, and on either side of her forehead, angry red circles marked her pale skin. I later learned that this was where hot, dry cups were placed during treatments by the physician in his attempt to draw the madness from her brain. Frightened at what I had begun, I watched her slow approach but refused myself the temptation to run. As she peered out, her hot eyes met mine. I could scarcely breathe. "Miss Martha," I said, "it's me, Isabel." She gripped the fence with one hand to steady herself, then closed her eyes slowly and opened them again. When she reached through, her fingers brushed the side of my face. "Isabel," she whispered. "Yes." She pulled her frail hand back, then reached out again and softly placed the palm of her hand to the side of my neck. I was at a loss until I heard myself spontaneously recite a favorite passage from Suki's bedtime story. As I finished the recitation with, "Anne declares that she shall ride in her own coach," Miss Martha's hand began to tremble. "Baby?" she asked. "Baby is at home," I said. "She is waiting for you." Miss Martha stared at me. Then her shrill screams pierced the air, setting off others as they joined her cries. I ran then, first to collect Meg, then to head for home. As upset as I was after seeing Miss Martha that day,
I still, in my naivete, believed in her recovery. Alone I returned to the Madyard whenever I could summon the courage, but I did not see Miss Martha out until the following spring. Again I called to her, but this time she did not respond.
Distressed, I went to Miss Sarah, and without telling her the reason, asked that I be allowed a visit to the hospital.
However, my request disturbed her to such a degree that I did not pursue it. I did, though, through the next years, continue to observe Miss Martha at the yard whenever I was able.
Chapter 30. Belle. The first time I get a letter from Lavinia, I know being there is hard on her. Not by what she says, but by what she don't say. She don't ask about Suki, about Mama, about the twins. Lavinia's letter says she's got a tutor and she's living in the big house. I can see that her lessons are going good, because Lavinia's already writing good as the captain. First, I'm thinking that I won't write back. I'm afraid that my writing don't look good as hers. But Mama says you write her. She don't care about nothing but that we all missing her. So, I get out my dictionary, and I write to Lavinia. I say that Jamie is just the best baby, and that he's growing like something in my garden. I don't tell her that he looks just like the white boy, and that I'm worried about his one eye clouding over. I tell Lavinia that the twins and Mama say hi, but I don't say that Mama's getting over a hard time, losing another baby herself. She says at her age she's too old to carry one, and I'm thinking she's right. By my figuring, she's got to be getting close to 50. I tell Lavinia that this place is running real good, that Will Stevens is doing a fine job. Ida says everybody's happy down at the quarters, but we all know it don't stay like this when Marshall comes back. Course, I don't tell Lavinia that Ben and me get together every chance we got. And for sure I don't tell her about the time that Mama May gives me the eye when she says, I guess you know that Lucy's getting big with another baby. No? You sure about that? I ask. You look at her. You sure too? Mama says. Next time I see Ben, I push him away. All this time you're with me, you're still getting on Lucy? I ask. Belle, he says, you know you the one for me. But Lucy with me too. You know this. You send her back to the quarters where she belongs, I say. But then Ben gets mad. That girl know about you, but she don't say nothing. She already got it hard, working the fields. And she a good mama to my boy. I don't send her back down like she's some dirt. She's staying, and that be that. He turns to go. I'm still mad about Lucy's baby, but I know I got to take Benny like he is. Come here, I say. Then I kiss him good and make him want me like he's a starving man.
Chapter 31. Lavinia. As Meg and I grew older, Miss Sarah used our close relationship to teach the two of us the social skills required of young ladies in Williamsburg. Miss Sarah counted on my influence, as Meg often opposed these lessons, objecting to the time they took away from her beloved bird and nature study. I, on the other hand, knew it was in my best interest to please Miss Sarah, so I paid close attention. These were the polite accomplishments, she said, and was determined that we would not fall short in achieving them. Initially, Miss Sarah's schooling attended to instructions as mundane as how to curtsy or how to correctly enter and exit a room. Gradually, though, these lessons became more sophisticated and included tasks such as how to act as hostess when presiding over a meal. Although having tea was not the ritual that it became in later years, the serving of it followed a certain pattern, and according to Miss Sarah, it was an important social skill that every young lady was required to know.
Meg thought the whole subject a bore, but I was genuinely intrigued and encouraged her participation. As tea was very dear, Miss Sarah had her own tea caddy, a small box made of rosewood, in which the precious commodity was kept under lock and key. Her beautiful tea set, imported red and white porcelain from China, had cups with no handles and a low squat teapot that differed so from a tall coffee pot. For the tea ceremony, Miss Sarah carefully directed us in all the necessary equipment. I was keen to learn this task, so Miss Sarah employed my eagerness as example.
"You must be more careful, Meg. Watch Lavinia. See how she pours."
Despairing of Meg's lack of interest, Miss Sarah tried another approach. Using my 15th birthday as a means for exercise, she drew on Meg's fondness for her cousin and sent word to Marshall that Meg would host a tea in my honor the following Saturday afternoon. Could he attend, and would he bring a gentleman friend? Meg was irritable from the start. Not 15 minutes into it, the young man accompanying Marshall lost favor when he, with supercilious abandon, announced his disfavor of women studying Latin. Meg quickly replied that immature men with strong opinions were, by her estimation, very dull indeed. There was a long silence while Miss Sarah stared at Meg. Remembering my obligation, I fought unsuccessfully to recall a favorable subject to engage our stunned guests. Then, and I believe it was a true accident, in the passing of a full cup, Meg spilled some of the hot liquid in her guest's lap. That ended poorly when the young man made an unkind comment, and as he departed abruptly, Meg ran from the room in tears. Miss Sarah, red-faced, did not stop to make apologies before she left the room to set things straight with Meg. Mr. Madden, not yet home from business, was not witness to Marshall and me laughing together at the debacle. As the lone hostess, I decided there was only one thing left to do. I poured the rest of the tea and offered Marshall the last of the crumpets. When there was a conversational lull, I remembered my duty and asked my guest about himself. I listened for quite some time as Marshall went on, noting with an inward smile how right Miss Sarah had been when she said that no man could resist talking about himself. Marshall finished by saying that though he enjoyed the study of law, he was only marking time. "For what?" I asked. He looked surprised at my question.
"To go home."
"Of course," I said. I was so taken aback at his announcement that I lost the ability to call forth another question. I looked down and began to smooth the embroidered pink edging on the sleeve of my new birthday dress.
"And you?" he asked. "What do you want in your future?"
When I looked up, his blue eyes observed me so intently, and his smile was so genuine, that I quickly looked down again, this time to straighten my skirt. "I am not certain," I said. I was saved when the hallway clock struck. I quickly remarked at the hour. Taking my cue as a gentleman would, Marshall rose and announced it was time to leave. As he prepared to depart, he asked if Meg was planning other social events. "I have no idea," I said.
"Well,"
he said in a most serious tone,
"could you please send me word, before I make a commitment to attend, whether or not the event involves hot liquid?"
We laughed again. Before Marshall left, he picked up my hand, bowed formally, and with merry eyes, said how very much he had enjoyed my company. "And I yours," I replied, and produced a curtsy. I sat for a long while after his departure and pondered my confused state. Since Marshall's unfortunate bout with drink, he had been on his best behavior. Something about the episode appeared to have freed him, and once again he was making every effort to please the Maddens. Marshall intrigued me. He was older and, in my eyes, worldly and sophisticated. Although he was always reserved with others, he put on another face when alone with Meg and me. Never did he make me feel less than his equal. Yet, although no one spoke of this, I wondered if I was not still considered his family's servant.
I set those thoughts aside when Mr. Madden appeared. He took a seat and asked how the afternoon had gone. Before I had time to answer, Meg, red-eyed, joined us to sit on a stool at her father's knee. Taking his hand, she pleaded that he intercede with Miss Sarah on her behalf. She could not bear a lifetime of this. When Miss Sarah entered, Meg's words ripe in the air, I decided it was time to go to my room. Meg continued to object to her mother's tutoring. What was the point? She questioned. She further horrified her mother when she announced that she did not plan to marry, nor did she plan to take part in a social life, as it only took time away from her studies. I was sensitive both to Miss Sarah and to Meg, and because of that I was able to intervene. Meg had a sense of fun, and as long as I approached the instruction with levity, Meg made an honest attempt to learn the basics. Then, too, when Miss Sarah tired of Meg's frequent opposition, I drew attention to myself. I asked questions and took pride in executing what I learned. Miss Sarah did not miss my contribution and praised me often for my good influence. Her focus on me did not trouble Meg in the least. On the contrary, Meg spoke to me of her gratitude. Of course, there were days when I, too, grew tired of Miss Sarah's scrutiny, but I quickly brought myself to order when I reminded myself how fortunate I was to have this opportunity. I was becoming more and more concerned about my future. It was never spoken of, but I knew my time here was limited. Miss Sarah had hinted that one day I might marry, but where a husband could be found I did not know. We did little socializing since Meg opposed most outside invitations, and as she matured her stand only grew more firm. I did not know where to turn with my concerns. I no longer communicated regularly with Belle. Painfully, I was coming to realize that I would not be returning to Tall Oaks. Through sporadic visits to Miss Martha, I saw that her condition only appeared to be worsening, and I doubted that she would ever go home. In my 15th year, I began to entertain thoughts of locating my brother. I had always dreamed of finding him. Now, along with my longing to be reunited with him as family, I reasoned that he was of an age where he might be in a position to be of assistance to me. Given my good fortune with the Maddens and their extreme generosity, I was reluctant to approach them with a request for their help. I did not want them to think that I was ungrateful, nor that I wished to leave their home. Thus I was silent about Cardigan until an unexpected opportunity presented itself. Sunday mornings were always taken up with church services, followed by socializing, wherein invitations were extended or accepted for the afternoon dinner. Mr. Madden preferred the company of steady friends, so it had recently become routine to have Mr. Boren and his young daughter at the Sunday dinner table. Mr. B., as Meg called him, was a partner in her father's business. In the previous years the unfortunate man had lost his wife, the mother of his 6-year-old daughter, to complications following the birth of a stillborn child. In recent months, Miss Sarah had taken it upon herself to help Mr. B. find a second wife. To date, Miss Sarah had been unsuccessful, as she had rather rapidly run through all of her possible candidates. It was quite clear to me why this was so. To begin, Mr. B. made a poor presentation of himself, though it was uncanny how physically alike he was to Mr. Madden. Of similar age, possibly around 45, Mr. B. was also short and plump, balding and bespectacled. But that was where the likeness ended. Mr. Madden was well-dressed, neat and tidy in appearance, and was the social equal to his wife. Under all circumstances he knew the etiquette required, and although he was a private man who preferred solitary pursuits when obligation demanded, Mr. Madden rose to the occasion with outstanding form. Mr. B., on the other hand, was disheveled and unkempt. His true failing was a shyness that so affected him he was unable to converse without stammering and stumbling for words. To observe him attempt conversation was painful, and I often found myself jumping to his rescue. Apparently he was grateful for my help, and after the third or fourth Sunday dinner he sought me out to express the same. I must mention how taken I was with Mr. B.'s delightful daughter, Molly. She was around the same age that I had been when orphaned, and for this reason I felt a kinship toward her. She was well-mannered and of a curious nature, and following the Sunday meals I usually spent time next to her on the settee. There we played at games while she plied me with questions about my childhood.
It was snowing outside the winter afternoon that Mr. B. approached me. Molly and I were playing a game of dominoes, and while I waited on her next move, I glanced up. This day, particularly, there was an intimate feel in the room, helped out by the crackling fire. As I gazed about the room, I saw Mr. Boren's advance. So clear was his discomfort, I immediately urged him to take a seat. It was his disability that gave me courage, for he was a gentleman of an age that otherwise would have intimidated me. Miss Sarah, always observing my manners, gave a nod of approval, but as the man sat, I caught Meg's look of reproach. I flashed her a smile before I turned my attention to Mr. Boren. He situated himself, and then, as Molly and I conversed, he edged into the conversation. He appeared to be as eager as his daughter to learn more of my past. Molly had already told him that I was an orphan, he informed me. Had I no other family? Only a brother, lost to me, I said. How was this so? Father and daughter both questioned. When I looked over and saw the Maddens in discussion, and Meg distracted by a book, I decided to tell my tale. At the finish, after a short silence, Mr. B. astonished me when he suggested that he might be able to assist in finding my brother. I hesitated only briefly, but he guessed the reason and assured me that he would first seek the approval of the Maddens. Grateful beyond measure, I wasted no time in telling him so. The man grew red while Molly took my hand in hers and rested her head against my shoulder. After supper, the Maddens asked me to stay with them when Meg retired early to her room. They informed me that Mr. B. had asked for their permission to look for my brother. They voiced disappointment. Why had I not come to them? If only I had asked, they would have carried out the search themselves. After I explained, they offered me their full support, but they hastened to warn me that the search could take many months. They added that oftentimes such a quest ended in vain, and I was to keep in mind that my brother might never be found. Their concern, coupled with my excitement, threatened to move me to tears, but as Miss Sarah often lectured Meg on emotional outbursts, I held myself together. Miss Sarah concluded by saying that Mr. Boren was a good man, and she was very pleased with the way I had put the poor man at ease. I left the room ready to burst from happiness, but I waited until I reached the stairs before I gave way to my excitement. Then I bounded up the steps two at a time and squealed as I flew into Meg's room. She did not share my happiness. Instead, she was filled with forewarning. "He is using this as an opportunity," she said. I sank into a chair. An opportunity for what? "You know that Mr. Boring is looking for a wife?" she asked, sitting opposite me on the edge of her bed. "It's Mr. Boran, Meg." "It's Mr. Boring," she said, and threw herself back on her bed with a great sigh, then flung her arm over her eyes. I laughed. "This isn't funny, Vinny," she said, peeking out from under her elbow. "Next he'll be proposing to you." "Please, Meg." I was astonished that she could even think along those lines. "I'm only 15 years old. He is as old as your father." "That wouldn't hinder him, nor would it stop Mother if she thought there was opportunity for you," Meg replied. As I prepared for bed that evening, I thought of Meg's words, but I soon dismissed her concern. Certain I would be reunited with my brother, I would let nothing cloud my happiness. That very night I sat at my desk and, for the first time in a long while, wrote a letter to Belle. I told her of the search for Cardigan, and how I knew that within him lay the answer to my future. I then set before her my plan. Once I was settled with him, I would send for her and Jamie. I always looked forward to Saturdays, when Marshall came to teach and then to spend the day. As we matured, our friendship grew and at times took on a flirtatious note. Increasingly, I found him attractive and often saw him studying me. Occasionally, he would tease me, and I felt quite pleased with myself when he laughed aloud at my returning quips. When Marshall periodically experienced his dark moods, as Meg labeled them, I was flattered to see that I was the one who could best pull him out. Then something of a more serious nature occurred,
which might have given me pause, but did not. During a class, Marshall and I began bantering, and Meg, attempting to dampen our sport, silently peered at us over the top of her spectacles. Her serious demeanor only encouraged us, and together we teased her to join our fun.